My name is Sean Allen, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Great Fact Group in Hollywood, California. And that's the end of the facts. All the rest of this stuff is my opinion, and I'm not a spokesman for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not an expert on alcoholism. But I got a couple of opinions. I want to thank the committee for asking me to be here. This is a real privilege. It just is. I mean, to be useful is an amazing feeling, you know, because I was shooting for decorative. I just wanted to be welcome. I didn't want to be useful, for God's sake. And but God seems fit to have me. I suppose my use in Alcoholics Anonymous is God uses me to talk to smart asses. That's basically what I'm used for. They seem to identify on a gut level with me. This has been extraordinary for me so far. Howard spoke this morning, and Howard is very important to me. Howard doesn't know that. Howard is one of those people that I was raised with in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was kind of bouncing around at the meetings that I was bouncing around at, and he was sharing. And his intelligence and his gentleness and his humor changed my life. I mean, he said half things from the podium that just, you know, changed me or changed a direction in my life. And it was a real privilege to hear him today because I was telling him later, as he was talking, I was saying, oh my God, that's where that comes from. That's why I believe that. Because Howard was raised in the same kind of sobriety that I was raised in. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, what Alcoholics Anonymous is a scattering of tribes is basically what it is. And each area has its own peculiar kind of personality and its own peculiar kind of people who communicate the program in a certain way. And so we kind of grow up with a kind of sobriety. And Howard was one of the teachers of my kind of sobriety. He'll probably be embarrassed from now on hearing what he hath wrought, but that's a, you know. I started getting drunk when I was 14 years old. I had several legitimate reasons. I was tall, I was fat, I had thick glasses and crooked teeth, and I was weird. And I was considerably uncomfortable with that set of circumstances, but I found comfort. Southern comfort is what I found. And if you're 14 years old and drink four tumblers full of Southern comfort, save your Confederate money, boys, the South will rise again. And on my worst day sober, it is better than my first day drinking because at least I'm not puking through my nose, you know. And that's what I did that first night. I also woke up several hours later underneath a bush, and I could hardly wait to do it again. I just thought it was terrific, you know. I'd been living all my life under the crushing burden of potential. People had always said, you're so bright, Sean, if you just apply yourself. And that night I met my potential. I was everything I needed to be. I could talk to you. I could dance with you. I could do God knows what with you. And I did. Whenever I could. I was a periodic alcoholic from that time until I was 20 because I couldn't get the stuff. I've always looked younger than I am. And so it was hard to get the stuff. When I was 17 years old, my mother became concerned that I was working too hard during exam time. She gave me one of her diet pills. God bless that woman. Because up until that point, I'd been a lousy drinker. I got very drunk, very fast, and very little. But when I dropped that speed, my God, I could stay up all night and drink it all, and I did. When I was 18 years old, I declared myself an alcoholic, and I didn't know that I had done it. I said the phrase that only an alcoholic says. If you're not sure, but you've said this phrase, if you've ever heard anybody say it, you're looking at a drunk, and that phrase is, I can control my drinking. Social drinkers never deal with that concept. Just never do. If they do something foolish whilst drinking, they stop drinking. You ever notice that? It's dreary, but that's what they do. But I was 18 years old. I've been drinking for 4 years. I've been taking drugs for a year, and I was in trouble with the chemicals. But the prospect of living without them was even more terrifying, you know. So I started doing the thing that chapter 3 talks about. I started to try to control and enjoy my drinking. Now, I don't know about you, but that equation never went together for me. That never happened to me. Never happened to me. When I was controlling my drinking, I was not enjoying it. And when I was enjoying it, it was wildly out of control. It just never went together. I'm a child of the 60s, and we're the generation that made drug abuse middle class. We're the ones that took a perfectly respectable disease called alcoholism and mucked it up. We added a couple of things to the recipe. We kind of expanded the definition of alcoholism. And when we started crawling into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, we expanded the definition of sobriety. And for us, just for us, the definition of sobriety is clean and sober. And it has to be that way for me, because I suffer from something called the phenomenon of craving. It's something that's unique in alcoholics. And any kind of chemical that alters my mind, anything that changes me from the neck up, sets off that phenomenon. And I've seen it happen to me long after I was sober. I went in the hospital for a minor operation, and they gave me something to put me out, some pain med. And my sponsor came to see me after it was over, and the first thing I asked him was, "What time is it?" And then I was acutely uncomfortable for a couple of days after they took away the prescription. You know, I just kind of, dis-ease, you know what I mean? So clean and sober is the only way that I can survive. I decided about 18 or 19 that the insides were never going to get any better, because I had stopped asking questions as a child. It's real interesting for me to find out about my childhood, because I'm now a parent, and it's very interesting. My mother is telling me a lot of stuff about what I was like as a kid, and my little kid goes to nursery school, and they all get to, they've got this little plot in nursery school. You say, "What happened today at school, darling?" And she says, "Nothing." You know, my brother and I, when we were children, I was telling that to my mother, and she said, "Oh yeah," she said. When your brother and you would go to school, you'd come home and I would say to me, "What happened at school?" And I would say, "Nothing." My brother would tell everything that happened from the beginning to the end. He had just these incredible adventures. But I was protecting myself from God knows when. And I don't know why. I don't know why. You know? I don't know why my brother and I were raised in exactly the same circumstances. We are 22 months apart, and we're totally different. We were in the same environment for years and years and years. And he is utterly different than I am. He does not drink, never has. And so I was a secretive kid because I decided that I had been damaged in the shipping somehow. I decided very, very early, and I made a decision based on the way that I gathered evidence. I compared my insides with your outsides, and I could tell that you were all doing just fine. But there was something terribly wrong with me. I decided I was crazy. Now, I was crazy, but I wasn't stupid. I knew that if you acted crazy, they took you someplace and never brought you back. So I was crazy, but I was careful. I developed social skills immediately. I learned how to say please and thank you. I learned what fork to use. I learned how to say please and thank you. I learned how to be reasonably academic in school, reasonably athletic. I tried desperately to be a nice guy so that you wouldn't know that I was nuts. But that was my big secret. Now, one of the things that I learned very early is that if you got something like that going on, you don't ask anybody any questions because they'll find out. So I had stopped asking questions, and I had started making up answers. And my solutions are always worse than my problems. Always. Always worse than my problem. So by the time I was 18 or 19, I was in trouble because I hadn't asked any questions. I didn't know how to do anything. I knew how to imitate. I had developed attitudes instead of emotions. And I was a human being impersonator. You know? I had no idea why you acted the way you did. I just pretended to be like you. And so I decided to hell with the insides. They weren't going to get any better, so I'll work on the outside. So I was doing a lot of amphetamines, and you tend to drop a lot of tonnage when you're doing that. You know, who wants to shut up long enough to eat lunch? And I, and I got a job together, and I got myself a pair of contact lenses, and I got my teeth capped, and shazam, I was good looking. And I liked that. A lot of people started noticing me. They also noticed that after I'd had a couple of belts, I was capable of doing anything, and consequently I stand before you this afternoon with no fantasy unlived. I have done everything that has ever occurred to me to do. I am deeply grateful there's some things that I never thought of. But there aren't many. You're getting into costumes toward the end there. Bob was talking Friday night. I was going, oh yeah, I did that. Oh yeah, I did that. Oh yeah. And when I was 21, I decided I had a talent that the world couldn't live without, so I went to New York. And within 2 months, I had my first Broadway show. Now, I then proceeded to live a life beyond anything that I'd ever dreamed of doing or being, you know? For this fat, ugly, insecure kid from Victoria, British Columbia, suddenly, I was on Broadway. You know? I was one of the cutest chorus boys on Broadway. I had this little modeling career. I was going to all the right parties. I was balling all the right people. I was roaring around in limousines. I was living the kind of life that people envied. You know, and by the time I was 24, I'd done several Broadway shows. I knew a lot of people. And I was drinking a quart of scotch a day, and I'd picked up a little non-habit forming marijuana habit. And I was working the docks. The doctors. God, I loved the doctors. Those idiots. They were terrific. See, I was never a street junkie. I had insurance. I had developed sincerity as a weapon, and I would go and sincerely tell them about my problems, and they would sincerely medicate me. It was fabulous. It was fabulous. See, I was dealing with the arrogance and the ignorance of the medical profession. It still pervades. It's just terrific. You see, the thing that most doctors know about alcoholism is based on 4 to 6 hours of classroom time as students, and then when they're interns in emergency wards, they see Skid Row bums brought in on stretchers, and they think that's alcoholism, you know. And then we go and lie to them. Every doctor that I ever talked to, I told them exactly the same thing that I told the last arresting officer. Two beers. That's all I ever drank. Two beers. You know? And see, they're so interested in condo projects and tax shelters that they don't bother to learn anything about alcoholism. And basically, we got it. You know, one of the things we got to understand here is that the medical profession, despite those big care units they built, they don't really like alcoholism as a disease. It's a disease that pisses them off, let's face it. I mean, first of all, it's incurable, and that hurts doctors' egos. They don't like incurable diseases. It makes them feel inadequate, you know? And the other thing is, if you medicate us, we get worse. You know? And miracles scare the shit out of them. I mean, they really don't want to hear about spiritual things. I mean, that just really makes them nervous. You know? So they'd prefer that we were crazy rather than drugs. They'd prefer that we had anything else but alcoholism, you know? And basically, you know, what do they know? What do they know about the pills they prescribe for us? I mean, you know, come on. You know, their information is coming from guys who work for pharmaceutical companies who come in with their little, you know, that's not exactly an unbiased source of information, you know? And then we lie to them. We just lie to them. We lie to them. We lie to the psychiatrists, you know? We do all that kind of stuff. But I was 24 and I was in trouble. I had life problems, you understand. Now, I knew about alcoholism. My father was getting sober about that time, and I knew it killed old dudes with cirrhosis of the liver. What I didn't want to look at was how it was killing us young, cute, adorable ones. Those of us with big blue eyes and straight teeth. Those of us who were living the kind of life people envy. Those of us who were perfect size 40 regulars. Those of us who were eating hands full of vitamins. Those of us who were exercising regularly. Those of us who were in fabulous shape. You know, I didn't want to look at how it was killing us. I didn't want to acknowledge the fact that my best friend who got drunk with me at 14 as a freshman in college on a football scholarship hanged himself because he couldn't kick a drug habit, and that's alcoholism. I didn't want to talk about my best friend in New York, who was one of the cutest chorus boys on Broadway. I was the other one. He was a diabetic, and he drank like I did. And by the time he was in his mid-20s, he was blind, and he was senile, and he didn't want to live anymore, so we pulled a plug on his kidney machine, and that's how he died, and that's alcoholism. And another friend of mine used to do suicide attempts. Now, I don't know if you remember suicide attempts. They're so difficult to time, aren't they? They really are. You know, when you take the pills and you make the phone call knowing they'll show up in time? You know. Or you open the car door on the freeway and you lean out real slow so somebody will grab you before your face actually hits the pavement, you know? Terry was a brilliant English actor. Brilliant English actor. And he used to kill himself in regular intervals. It was a game. We'd call each other and say, "Oh, he's killed himself again." We'd all go over there and we'd make him throw up. And then we'd walk him around Central Park all night. And it was a game. And one night he got very drunk and he took a whole lot of pills. And he made a phone call and the paramedics showed up in time. But they gave him just a little too much oxygen to bring him around. And he has been a vegetable in a VA hospital for over 20 years. He weighs about 35 pounds. He's in a fetal position. And the only thing that's keeping him alive is machines. But he doesn't have any parents, so they can't turn him off. That's alcoholism. We don't always die. And one of the things that I have to remember at gatherings like this, which are so terrific, I love conferences. I love being here. I love hearing the speakers. I love being part of it. But this is not a drag cocktail party. This is life and death. And I have to remember that because sobriety gets sweet, sobriety gets easy, sobriety gets exciting, sobriety gets to be the kind of adventure I have always wanted to live. And I've got to remember that we're dealing with life and death. That for any one of us in this room who is alcoholic, to take a drink is to die. And I've got to understand the devastation of that disease. And nowadays, we have to adjust our thinking for the newcomers that are coming in. You know? The newcomers who are coming in have a deadly combination of alcohol and drugs, which makes this disease progress with lightning rapidity. It just goes like that. I mean, the newcomers who are coming in don't even get to go to cocktail parties, for God's sake. You know? They start, and a year later, they're at death's door. You know? It's incredible. They're kids in our group. We've got two girls who are 15 years old, who have 2 years of sobriety. They're coming in 11 and 12 and 13 years old, as devastated as any 40-year-old that I ever saw. You know, we also got all those nice little housewives from the Pacific Palisades who are coming in and kicking the worst Valium things I've ever seen in my life. You know, there's some stuff going on in Alcoholics Anonymous that has got to be acknowledged and has got to be dealt with. There's people who don't have time anymore. They're young, and they're defiant, and they're dying. And so I got to remember where I came from, because it took a while for me to get here. One of the things that I decided to do when I was 24 was I decided to go to a shrink, and I did. I entertained him for 8 months, and he helped me. He got me down to a fifth of scotch a day, and he gave me a prescription for Valium and another one for Seconal. God bless that man. Now, I don't put down psychiatrists, I really don't, because, they're incapable of helping us because we're incapable of telling the truth. It's that simple, you know. The other thing, too, is basically the reason psychiatry is not as effective for alcoholics as Alcoholics Anonymous is it takes the wrong tack. Basically, the approach of psychiatry is first we will come to understand your feelings and then we will change your behavior. And what Alcoholics Anonymous says is first we'll change your behavior and then your feelings will change. And that works for us, you know. The other thing, too, is they don't have that magic phrase. None of those professionals out there have that magic phrase. And before we get enchanted with them, remember the thing that saves lives. You know, and none of the psychiatrists that I saw, none of the social workers, none of the therapists, none of the priests, none of the nuns, none of the Christian Brothers of Ireland, none of the learned relatives, none of the policemen, the lawyers, or the judges, when I told them what my problem is, had any help for me because they did not have the phrase that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you have it. And that's what makes you miracle workers. Do not underestimate what God has given us here, because you are miracle workers, because you can look at somebody like me and say the thing that it will save my life, and that is, I know how you feel. I know how you feel. And you always have. You always have. When I have been honest enough to tell you what was actually going on, you have always said, I know how you feel. And that's why I'm standing here. That's why I got 13 years of sobriety. It's nothing really that I've done. I've been willing to follow instructions. But you have taught me that no matter what, you were there for me. And I was real lucky, you know. I was real lucky because I got sober before, you know, before the medical profession and the insurance companies found out we were big business, you know. I got sober before that. Thank God, you know, because way down deep I'm shallow. You know, let's get that out of the way. You know, I mean, you're not looking at any intellectual giant here. You know, I've been interested in the softer, easier way all my life, and I found it in AA. But if somebody had told me that recovery, you know, took 10 days and a couple of weekend follow-ups, I'd have been out there, man. You know? The idiot who came up with that phrase ought to be hanged in a public square. Because that kind of nonsense kills alcoholics. That kind of nonsense kills alcoholics. This is not a trivial disease. And unfortunately, those care units and those hospital programs have done that to this disease. In order to sell that thing, you've got to make this disease look attractive, and there ain't a damn thing that's attractive about this disease. This is a devastating killer disease. And those people out there who are trivializing it in order to make money ought to look to themselves. They ought to look to themselves very, very hard, because it's a very, very serious issue we're dealing with here. Anyway, I decided what I needed was a good woman, and I found her in an elevator. And she and I were going to do a show together. She was a little dancer. She was the cutest thing I'd ever saw in my life. She was little and blonde, and she had dimples and the cutest tuchus I ever saw. And I noticed her right off the bat. She didn't see me until 3 days later when my back went out and I crawled into rehearsal and zing went the strings of her heart. I didn't know that for an Al-Anon, a drunk crawling across a hotel lobby was like coming home. She realized at a very deep level that I needed her. And one of the things that I noticed as we got together was that I could do things that she couldn't, and she could do things that I couldn't. We kind of meshed together, you know? It was just terrific. It was just terrific. Our character defects kind of meshed together, you know? And what we became is, we became two crippled children trying to make one decent adult out of the two of us, you know? It was amazing. Our lunacies just meshed. It was great. And we started our dance of death, and eventually we tangoed into AA and Al-Anon, and she, you know, and I want to make something real clear, because I love Al-Anon. I love Al-Anon. I respect that program. You took a frightened, angry little girl and turned her into a beautiful woman that I am married to, and I am grateful to Al-Anon. I am grateful to Al-Anon. But I'll tell you something. Just because you're married to a drunk doesn't make you an Al-Anon. Working the 12 steps and the 12 traditions of the Al-Anon program makes you an Al-Anon. So anyway, we were the cutest kids on Broadway. We were just adorable. Our friends called us the Campbell Soup Kids. We had this cute little apartment in New York, and we were running around the theater. We ran around with all these fun people, and we drank a lot. Now, she drank a lot. Let me tell you, drunks do not marry teetotalers. I didn't know anybody who didn't drink. I wasn't going to marry anybody who didn't drink, for God's sake. And she could drink. My God, could she drink. It was terrific. It was terrific. So anyway, we took this national tour, and we came out to California, and we got married, and she settled down. And one day, we were having our cocktails. And I'll never forget it. She had a vodka Gibson in her hand, my drug of choice. And she took two sips of it, and she said, this is boring. And she put it down on the coffee table, and she never drank again. She didn't go through withdrawals. She didn't go berserk. She just didn't drink anymore. She doesn't have the disease. Then she noticed that I drank. And then I found myself in the worst possible circumstance that a drunk can be in. I loved my wife and I needed a drink. And I don't know about you, but I needed to drink because somewhere in my 20s, it had ceased to be a luxury for me. It was now a necessity. I was medicating myself. I knew that if I didn't drink, I would go insane. I just knew that. And you know, the drug that I had the most contempt for was alcohol. It was the most controllable. I knew the parameters, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I needed to drink. Now, when you're married to somebody that you love who doesn't drink, you got to shift the responsibility somehow. Now, if love could cure alcoholism, I wouldn't need to be here. I have been well loved for a long, long time. That woman loves me, and I know that. And I love her, and she knows that. And we have always wanted the best possible for each other. I've always wanted her to be the best possible human being she could be, and she's always wanted that for me. We have been supportive of each other. We have encouraged each other, and I would help her. I would say things to her like, "Oh, you're going to wear that dress." "You know, I've always liked your hair up." "I don't think you should have said that at dinner, darling. I think you upset the host." I mean, helpful things. So that she could become a better human being. And the clear-cut message in it was, if she was taller, if she was shorter, if she was brighter, if she wasn't so bright, if she worked, if she stayed home, if she wrote poetry, if she cooked, if she did the lawn, if she was a redhead, if she was a brunette, if she was somehow different, I wouldn't need to drink. And the sad thing about people who love alcoholics is she bought that. And I waited for the day when she would say, "Hold it. It's not my fault. You drink, I don't." But of course she never did. And what I was doing was I was crippling and hobbling that human being. It was amazing. I was trying to give her encouragement and I was destroying her at the same time, you know. And I needed to drink. And I needed somebody to run things, because what was happening was I was trying to survive now. I was just trying to survive. I was trying to get up for that goddamn job. You know, I was a functioning alcoholic. I had a wife who worked. You know? There was enough money to pay the bills. And she would. So whenever she mentioned my drinking, I would say, "But darling, the bills are paid. Back off." And she did. It was nuts. You know? And she was taking over. I mean, I couldn't do anything. Just getting out there and coming home was what I could do, you know? And so she was taking care of the bills, and she was working at two jobs, and she was, you know, calling the plumber when it needed to be done, and she was taking over everything, you know? And pretty soon she was starting to tell me what to do, so occasionally what I would have to do was just kind of pull the rug out from her, you know? Just have to do something crazy, just to throw her so that I could grab it back for a minute, just to let her know, because I was dying, and I didn't know what the hell was the matter. I didn't know what was going on. I knew I drank. I knew that was interfering, but I didn't know that it was killing me. I didn't know that it was destroying us. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know why she was shriveling in front of my face. I didn't know why her lips were disappearing. You know, that Al-Anon, you know. I didn't know why she wouldn't get her hair done. I didn't know why she wouldn't buy any clothes. I didn't know why her nails were bitten to the quick. I didn't know why she was bitchy to sales ladies. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what the matter was. I just knew that I had to drink. Because if I didn't drink, I would go insane. And all kinds of things were developing. I mean, I was getting paranoid. Oh. I was convinced that the checkers in the 7-Eleven stores after midnights were narcotics agents. And that if you bought too much chocolate ice cream, they'd bust you right there on the spot. You know. So I used to do these weird shoppings in the middle of the night, you know, all kinds of groceries so they wouldn't see the chocolate chip cookies and the ice cream in the middle of it. You know, I stoned out of my mind, you know. That's insane. I never drank in the morning. I knew if you drank in the morning you were drunk. I took Valium. That was acceptable. And it was insane. About 6 months before I got to the program, we had a vicious fight. Now, I have never been a physically violent alcoholic. I am an emotionally violent alcoholic. If you hurt my feelings, I'll find an interesting way for you to lose your job. And we had an incredible fight that I don't remember to this day. But it was vicious. And we crossed the... You know, an alcoholic marriage is a dance. An alcoholic marriage is carefully choreographed. And both the partners know that you can take 3 steps forward, 1 step back, 2 to the side. I mean, it is a very careful marriage. Make no mistake about that. It looks like chaos. It looks like insanity. But within the relationship, it is very careful. There are certain things that you just don't say. There are certain lines within that relationship that if you cross it, it's irreversible. And that night, I crossed some of them. I said the things that, the last phrase. And I came to the next day, and she realized that I didn't remember any of it, and she got terrified. And I started praying, and the prayer was, "Dear God, let this stop." He arranged it quite nicely. 6 months later, on April 23rd, 1974, I was arrested by the West Hollywood Vice Squad on a sleazy little charge. I was taken down and fingerprinted and photographed and released on my own recognizance. The front of my pants from the waistband to the knees was soaked in my own urine, and it got my attention. And the next day, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. The next day, I asked for help. The next day, I sought out somebody I'd been working with. She had 6 years of sobriety, and she was having a hell of a good time. I mean, she had her good days and her bad days, but she seemed to be able to handle her life. And on April 24th at 11 o'clock in the morning, I said the last phrase. I said, "I'm an alcoholic, and I have 20 minutes before I go to pieces." And that's absolutely true. And I thank God for the people who have got time in this program, because she heard the screaming, you know. She understood that I lived with a ball of screaming in my chest every day of my life. And on the good days, it sat right there in the middle. And on the bad days, it got up behind your vocal cords. And those are the days that if you have a broken shoelace or a flat tire, it'll slip past your vocal cords. And you'll scream and you'll scream and you'll scream. And they'll take you someplace and they won't bring you back. And she knew that. And she told me her story in the first miracle hour. Now, my story was sleazy. But hers was disgusting. And the first miracle happened. I thought, my God, if she can stay sober, I can. You know, and I don't have an interesting drunkologue. I never really did anything swell. You know? I never came to in Kathmandu or, you know, hijacked a tugboat or went to death row like a regular fella. I mean, you know... I just did a series of embarrassing, shabby, sleazy, tacky, smarmy, shady, nasty little things over and over and over again. Interspersed with promises that today it'll be different and occasional spectacular achievements. And if you looked at me, you might have thought that those spectacular achievements were designed to convince you that I was better than you, and that was never true. I always thought if I did something incredible, you'd think that I was equal to you. And that's where I was coming from. That's where I was coming from. If I wasn't special, I wasn't anything. And I knew that to be true. And so she took me to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was exactly as I feared it was going to be. It was in a church basement. It had gray walls, a low ceiling. It was filled with smoke. And all the people that I never would have drank with were there. Now, if you're new... If you're here to get your act together, rats are ruck, but let me tell you, if you're here to get your act together so you can drift on out of this thing, you know, let me tell you how I arrived. I came to my first meeting in a $250 sports jacket from Saks Fifth Avenue. I had in French gabardine slacks, Italian loafers, and a designer tie. I looked a little like I do now. Gorgeous, you know? I drove there in my Mercedes. I walked in and everybody knew that I was a drunk, and I couldn't figure that out. There were a couple of things that were going on that I wasn't aware of. One of them was I had been drinking straight vodka the night before, and it was a rather warm night. And I had on a lot of lemon-lime cologne, and I smelled like a gimlet. And the other thing that was going on was that I had newcomer eyes. And the only other place I've ever seen eyes like that, other than on a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous, are on a dog loose on a freeway. I was absolutely terrified. I was so terrified I didn't feel anything. You know? I had just shut down. I just kind of walked, you know. You were very kind to me. See, we're the last of the ones that shook it out in rooms like this, you know. We didn't have 28-day programs. We either did it in these rooms or we went to something called 12-step houses. 12-step houses sounded like something out of Dickens. And what they did with us newcomers is they gave us a half a cup of coffee because we were a little quick when we were coming off a lot of stuff, you know. And they didn't want to get their clothes soiled. You know, they were being very kind to us, but they had laundry bills, you know. Unfortunately, I was well-dressed. I was one of the crop that, you know, I was kind of well-dressed, and so they would get me to do things. I was about 4 days sober, and they asked me to read chapter 5, and I got up and read it and sat down. And the leader said it was the first time she'd ever heard it read in one breath. And I thought I loved Alcoholics Anonymous from the first day that I was here, and that's not true. I've always mistaken my emotions. I've always mislabeled them. I did not love Alcoholics Anonymous from the moment I arrived here. It wasn't love that I was feeling. What I felt was safe. It was the first place in my entire life that I felt completely safe. And that has gone on ever since. It's gone on ever since. No matter what my day is like out there, no matter what's going on, if I get here, get my styrofoam cup full of coffee and sit down in a smoky room and listen to some drunk tell his story, I'm safe for an hour and a half. And that's gone on every night since then, you know. I understood that you were here for me, and I was really delighted. There was no professionals. There were no professionals there. You made it very clear to me that the reason you were going to help me was to save your own ass. And I accepted that and thought that was terrific. It seemed honest. It seemed straightforward. And I knew that I was understood and accepted. And no matter what I had to do to stay sober, you were available to me. And it started for me. It started. You know what the hardest thing to do without a drink is? The hardest thing to do without a drink is to tell you who I am and ask you for help. Ask you for what I need. That has been the hardest thing in my life. That's why I drank. That's intimacy. That's intimacy. I'm not talking about sexual intimacy. I'm talking about telling you who I am and asking you for what I need. And the process started in Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor sat next to me in the first day that I was sober. It was a miracle. This little guy sat next to me, and he started talking. Well, the first thing he did was he shook my hand. One of the things that I noticed right off the bat was you couldn't keep your hands off of me. You were the touchiest people I'd ever met. And I'd never seen so many teeth in my life. And when you shook my hand, you wouldn't let go. You would not let go of my hand. And this little guy shook my hand, he wouldn't let go. I thought, if he doesn't let go, I'm going to throw up all over his head. And he's got these kind of soft blue eyes, and he looked up at me and he said, I'm not a psychiatrist, but if you call me tonight and you tell me how you feel and I tell you how I feel, probably neither of us will have to get loaded. And I started talking to him, and he started talking about his story. I mean, my God, he had done all the things that I had done. It was incredible. It was a spiritual awakening. He was the absolute perfect individual who sat next to me at my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I asked him to be my sponsor about a week later, and he's been my sponsor ever since. When I was 3 years sober, I found out something. First of all, when Suzanne 12-stepped me, she kept jumping up and running out of the room. I thought she was one of those ones with kidney damage. It turned out 3 years later, I found out, that she was running into her bedroom to make phone calls. And what she was doing was constructing this brand new life for me. Now, if you're new, I got some real disappointing news for you. The old-timers talk about rigorous honesty here, and then they lie like rugs. I mean, it's incredible. And the way they get away with it is they say, more will be revealed. Now I found out 3 years later that she had called Jack and told him to be at that meeting and put his keys down in that seat because she had a newcomer. She had told him, as I was telling my story to her, she was jumping up and telling it to him. He knew all about me that first night. I got set up. Thank God. Thank God. If I had chosen my sponsor, I'd have probably chosen a sober axe murderer. You know? Thank God they took that out of my hand. You know? And he started teaching me the steps. He started teaching me the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it's broken down real simple for us smart fellas. The first three steps tell you what you got to do. And then 4 through 9 tell you how you do it. And then 10, 11, and 12 tell you how to maintain it. And so I started. And he taught me surrender right off the bat. Now, I have a talent for surrender. I really do. I was willing to surrender to anybody with a louder voice or a stronger opinion than me all my life. I mean, it's possible for me to be surrendered and belligerent at the same time, you know. And I had surrender all mixed up with defeat and humiliation, and that's certainly how it felt when I first got here. I mean, and of course it was. But that's not what surrender is. And if you're new or if you're not so new and if you're dealing with or grappling with surrender, let me tell you what surrender is as I understand it, because it was made clear for me so that I could do it. Surrender has three parts. 2 out of 3 don't count. You got to do all three of the things or you remain with the problem. That's what I found in my case. And the three parts of surrender are honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. Ta-da! I mean, my entire sobriety is stumbling over the obvious. I mean, all this stuff you probably know. But that was big news to me. And the honesty in Alcoholics Anonymous is out loud honesty. It has never done me any good to tell me the problem. I have known what my problems were all my life. I've known what they were. I've had inner dialogues every day of my life. It did not do me any good at all until I was willing to tell you what the problem was. You know, and one of the ways that we had to do that was first my sponsor had to teach me something called accurate reporting. Accurate reporting is a hideous concept because the only way that I described myself was in dramatic terms. I was either in a homicidal rage or a suicidal depression or, you know, I mean, big terms for me. I mean, big to psychological disorders for days, you know. Lots of big medical terms to describe me. And so what my sponsor did was he immediately started honing down the information to what we were actually talking about. What we were actually talking about a lot of times was being embarrassed. I think embarrassment is the all-pervading emotion that I live with on a daily basis. I am constantly embarrassing myself. I act like a fool all the time. So I got like 42 emotions like everybody else does, and they're real ordinary and they're real plain and they annoy the hell out of me. Because what they do is they make me the same as you. I mean, if I'm in a homicidal rage, I'm a little